Good morning, good evening, and good day. This is your host, producer, and engineer, Roy of Hollywood, welcoming you again to Something's Happening. We'll be here till 6 a.m. with Dynamite Radio for Night People. And we're going to look deeply into the wonderful world of ethnopharmacological plants, and plant helpers and plant healers with Jonathan Ott live in studio, first time in a couple of years. Hi, Jonathan.
Good evening. Nice to be on your show, as always.
Well, I'm honored to have you here up from Mexico, and we're going to have to identify you for our newer listeners. You're a chemist.
Nominally so. I do have some training in chemistry. Actually, now I'm more engaged in writing as a career rather than chemistry. But, yes, I'm a phytochemist, and my specialty is entheogenic plants or shamanic inebriants or plant teachers and their ethnopharmacognosy.
What is a phytochemist and what is ethnopharmacognosy?
Well, a phytochemist is one who studies the chemistry of plants. I'm a natural products chemist, and I specialize in plants. Ethnopharmacognosy, you often hear the term ethnopharmacology. I prefer the term ethnopharmacognosy, in as much as pharmacology is the study of the effects of drugs in intact bodies. And I feel that what shamans do is better described by the word pharmacognosy, which is the study of the production, cultivation, processing, and use of drugs. And so I prefer the term ethnopharmacognosy, but it's more or less interchangeable with ethnopharmacology.
What is the difference between drugs and plants and in this study?
Between drugs and plants? Well, as far as the scientific definition is concerned, a plant is simply a crude drug.
A drug is a crude plant.
Right, or whatever. But drug is unfortunately a loaded term these days, and it has acquired rather a pejorative connotation. Drug, strictly speaking, is something bad in our culture, and I think for many people what drug means is something illegal, something dangerous, something prohibited. Alcohol, however dangerous it might be, is not usually considered to be a drug. I would use a broader designation, and for me, a broader definition of drug would be any pharmacologically active substance, plant, chemical, extract of plant, etc.
So, let me see. I'll go over, you have written, and we have discussed in the past, the pharmacotheon on entheogenic drugs. They're plant sources in history. It's sort of everything you could possibly want to know about every plant, pharmacotheon.
And quite a few things you probably didn't want to know as well, I might add.
And then their most recent book, Ayahuasca Analogs, Pangeon and Theogens. And then sort of secret, I thought it was out of print, the Cacahuatl Eater, The Ruminations of an Unabashed Chocolate Addict.
Yes. And I've just published a new book, hot off the press, so to speak, and it's entitled The Age of Entheogens and the Angel's Dictionary. And this consists of two essays. The first is The Age of Entheogens, the Pharmacratic Inquisition, and the Entheogenic Reformation. And it's an historical theory concerning the importance of entheogens in archaic religion, of entheogens meaning what some people call hallucinogens or psychedelics, but in this case the plants themselves, the shamanic plants, shamanic inebriants, or plant teachers, and there's the suppression of their use by what I have chosen to call the pharmacratic inquisition. And the phenomenon that we are seeing in the world today, which I call the entheogenic reformation, constitutes a rediscovery or a rebirth in use of these archaic sacramental plants. The second essay in the book is entitled The Angel's Dictionary, and it is in fact a dictionary of words pertaining to sacred inebriants, ecstatic states, and allied topics. It has about 320 words. Backed up by definitions from, by citations supporting the definitions.
Are these many languages or just?
Yes, the words are derived from Well, there, of course, the center of gravity in this case is English, but there are also some 70 words, if memory serves me, from non-Indo-European languages, from various indigenous tongues and so forth. Non-European languages, sorry. Some of them are Indo-European, some not. There are definitions are supported by quotations in the manner of the Oxford English Dictionary. I think there are a total of about 450 quotations culled from classical, drug, and general literature.
Entheogens. Strange new word. Entheogens. How does, what does it mean, and why is this term used instead of, the usual psychedelic plants or what other else? Psychedelics have been the most hallucinogenic, right?
Well, the commonest terms for this are psychedelic and hallucinogenic. Hallucinogenic is the most widely used term in the scientific literature. Psychedelic is the most widely used term in the counterculture and does have a good deal of currency in the scientific literature as well. Well, we proposed the term entheogen in 1979 in the Journal of Psychedelic Drugs, now the Journal of Psychoactive Drugs. An informal committee organized by my late teacher, R. Gordon Wasson, Carl Ruck, professor of classics at Boston University, and Danny Staples, also a classicist from Boston University, Jeremy Bigwood, and myself. We were looking for a term to describe what I would call shamanic inebriants, plants used by shamans to achieve ecstasy or out-of-body experiences or extraordinary states of consciousness, as they're sometimes called. The problem with hallucinogenic is that it is based on the notion of an hallucination, which to psychiatrists is a sign of pathology and a symptom of pathological.
That's seeing something that isn't there, really there.
Exactly.
You think it's there.
A lie. The essence of hallucination is you're seeing something that's not there, a distortion, a false perception. And psychedelic, the problem I see with psychedelic is that it is grounded in 60s countercultural use. The prototypical psychedelic drug is LSD. That's mainly what people took in the psychedelic era. And this, as we all know, is a product of modern pharmacological science. It has not yet been found to occur in a plant, although it may someday be found to do so. And so we speak of psychedelic music, psychedelic art. It's very definitely founded in the 1960s, especially in the United States, and it refers to non-traditional use of these substances. And it seems to me incongruous to speak of shamanic use of a psychedelic plant because of this connotation. And I might add that it has a decidedly pejorative connotation for people that are not in the counterculture. If you mention the word psychedelic, It evokes a very
dirty hippie,
right?
Crazed,
exactly. Dirtbag hippie, Mansonite, whatever. So entheogen means specifically, it derives from entheos, entheoi, a Greek root that means divine within, literally. We use the root commonly of the word enthusiasm, which means inspired by the divine. Literally, the divine is breathed into one. That's the true meaning of enthusiasm.
Entheos.
And so entheogen, adding the root, the suffix gen, meaning becoming, it gives you a word that means roughly becoming divine within. And we felt that this, it's not meant to describe the chemistry of these substances, nor is it meant to describe their pharmacology. It's meant to describe the cultural context of their use, or what we would call the set and setting. And so we felt that that best described the traditional use of these substances. And so it enables us to speak in the same breath of very diverse substances with very diverse pharmacological action. For example, those that favor the use of psychedelic, they're in agreement that the psilocybin and mushrooms are psychedelic. They would say that peyote and mescaline is psychedelic. But they will say normally, well, but the Amanita muscaria mushroom is not psychedelic. Neither is salvia divinorum psychedelic. So we needed a word to talk in the same breath about all of these substances, some of them with quite distinct pharmacological effects, and they're not all of them classic psychedelics in the mold of psilocybin, mescaline, ergot alkaloids like LSD. And so entheogen fits the bill. I would have to say that it's become widely accepted in the ethnographic literature. It's become the predominant term, in fact, in Spanish in general, but it hasn't gained any type of acceptance in the medical community nor among chemists and pharmacologists, but that's not surprising. It wasn't designed for them.
Okay, I want to also place you a little bit more in historical context. You mentioned your teacher, one of your teachers, R. Gordon Wasson.
Yes.
Now, R. Gordon Wasson sort of discovered for the modern world, our modern world, the mushroom.
Yes. Gordon Wasson was a banker from born in Montana, worked and lived in most of his career, worked in New York. And he and his wife, who was a Russian physician, embarked on a study of the linguistics of mushroom names in the 1920s, which they pursued very diligently over many years. And by the time the 50s drew around, they discovered rediscovered the surviving use of what we now know to be psilocybin mushrooms in Oaxaca, and it was on the night of the 29th through 30th of June, 1955, that Gordon Wasson, together with his photographer Alan Richardson, became the first outsiders on record intentionally to ingest these psilocybin mushrooms in a shamanic ritual with the Mazatec shaman Maria Sabina in the state of Oaxaca and Huautla de Jimenez. And this really, 2 years later, Wasson published he and his wife published an important book called Mushrooms, Russian History, which has had literally no impact on history in general, because there were only 500 copies, and it has very difficult to get. It's sold for as much as $10,000 a copy now. But that simultaneously, they published an article in Life magazine, rather Gordon Wasson did, and Valentina, his wife, published an article in This Week magazine, the Sunday supplement, the same week. And it were these two articles, especially the article in Life, which was called Seeking the Magic Mushroom, which really brought this to the attention of the world and catalyzed the psychedelic 60s. Although mescaline had been known since 1896, it hadn't been used much beyond fairly small and esoteric circles, mainly in Europe and secondarily in the United States. The LSD was discovered, its effect was discovered in 1943, and that the properties, extraordinary potency and properties of it were published in 1947. These were sort of waiting in the wings, there and ready, but it was this article in Life magazine, as far as we can tell, that really catalyzed this modern interest in use of these substances.
And that started, for a time, also the rush to Mexico and, by tourists interested in the mushrooms and the mushroom experience. And one of the poignant thoughts of your book on ayahuasca analogs is that you hope, as part of your work, to turn off the tap of tourism.
Yes.
As we can make these things ourselves without leaving our own backyard. So
yes, exactly. When Wasson published the Life magazine article, he changed the name of the village, he changed the name of the people, he changed the name of Maria Sabina. But in Mushrooms, Russian History, the actual facts were given. And much to his surprise, within a couple of years, large numbers of tourists on their own initiative were going to Huautla, neighboring villages, and they drew the wrong kind of attention to this phenomenon. Suddenly, the government had stationed garrisons of soldiers and police in Huautla. They were deporting busloads of foreigners. Maria Sabina and other shamans served jail sentences in Oaxaca City for allegedly pandering to this mushroomic tourist trade. And the mushrooms were illegalized in Mexico, and bad political attention was attracted to them. Now, that tourism eventually waned, largely because it was found that the mushrooms grew all over the world. And by the mid-70s, myself and some of my colleagues had published books, and not only on how to identify the wild mushrooms that grew in North America, Europe, Australia, the South Pacific, and so forth, but books describing very simplified and efficient methods for cultivating them, which gave rise to a truck farm sort of black market production for these things, which has been very much refined, and that put an end to this mushroomic tourism. Now we're seeing the same kind of thing in South America what I call ayahuasca tourism, especially developed in Peru, secondarily in Ecuador, and rudimentarily in Brazil. And this is most unfortunate because there's presently no stigma whatever attached to ayahuasca in South America. But it will only take, and I might add that whereas the mushroomic tourism was ad hoc, it was more or less individuals on their own initiative. Now there are people organizing tour groups and advertising in magazines like Shaman's Drum and Magical Blend, and there are fairly sophisticated operations around this ayahuasca tourism. And it will only accelerate the degradation of these traditions, however inevitable that might be, in situ, attract the wrong kind of political attention, cause legal problems for the shamans that use these things like ayahuasca traditionally. And we know now that it is possible to make analogs of ayahuasca. It is possible to make ayahuasca from other plants that grow on other continents. And there's really no reason for this. And I feel that if people could make this themselves, not only would they not wish to spend $3,000 going on an ayahuasca tour, but they would also probably have a more serious use. They would, rather than seeing it as a type of commodity that you pay to get access to, they would establish a personal relationship with growing the plants, learn how to process them themselves, and I feel in general this would be conducive to more satisfactory experiences.
You also worked sort of with Albert Hoffman, who accidentally discovered LSD, and you translated his original book, into English, LSD, My Problem Child?
Yes. The German edition came out in 79 and the English in 1980, and that's still in print in a paperback edition from Tarcher in Los Angeles.
Okay, so I think that establishes you in situ, if not in history.
I hope so.
Is what you're studying, what you're bringing out, a worthwhile addition to our culture, or is this unleashing a destructive force?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. It's not for me to say, perhaps. Certainly, I think it's a worthwhile addition to our culture. I think it's I see in entheogens in this end of century, end of millennium decade as a sort of, I call it a healing balm for the lesions of materialism. I see it as being about the only hope we have for reducing or reversing rather the destructive trend that is so evident in the world today, ecological destruction, habitat destruction, species extinction. I think the only thing that really holds out sufficient hope for reversing that is the entheogenic experience. So in that sense, I feel it is definitely a positive cultural influence. On the other hand, I would say that in part, what I call the pharmacratic inquisition or the suppression of the use of plant sacraments or entheogens historically has very much to do with the fact that these represent a threat to authority, to hierarchical power structures and centralized authority systems. And they very accurately perceive this as being a threat to them. And so in that sense, it's subversive and is destructive to the powers that be.
How would you describe the entheogenic experience and what it can add or subtract in your life? Boy, is that a big question.
Right. Yes, it is. And I will preface it by saying I can only describe it for myself. And I know that this experience is very variable, both in any one individual and from one individual to another, even talking about the same plant or plant extract at the same dose in the same physical setting, same time of day, whatever. There's a considerable individual variation, and I will underscore again, I'm only speaking for myself. But if I were to try and put it into scientific terms, I would say it enables one to see the universe more as energy and less as matter. That's why I see it as being a healing balm for the lesions of materialism. It's the concept of hallucinogen is totally wrong in that it presupposes that when one takes a substance like this, it's distorting perception to such an extent that one sees hallucinations, falsities, things that aren't there, inaccurate perceptions. I see these substances rather as dehallucinogens, and I think that's a pretty typical traditional conception of them.
Dehallucinogens.
In other words, to put it in the terms of that the Hindus use, the world is Maya or illusion. Our quotidian or everyday perception of the world as solid and material, as permanent, that is definitely an hallucination. If you look at some of the far-out theories of modern physics and so forth, it's not really the way the world is supposed to be. And if we look at it scientifically, we conceive of the universe or the physical universe as consisting of space and energy. The appearance of solidity or solid objects is strictly an artifact of the coarseness of our level of perception. If we had a much finer level of perception, we wouldn't be able to perceive solidity. And so I feel when I take entheogens, I get into this more or less non-materialistic state where I perceive the universe more as energy, or you could say as spirit, less as matter. And in the right circumstances, it's not perceived as matter at all, but just as energy and dynamic flux. That's what science tells us is there. And obviously, for survival purposes, we need to perceive the world as solid and material. Now, our brain, we tend to think of our sensory organs as windows onto the world, but it's also possible to conceive of them as filters, filtering out what Blake called narrow chinks in the cavern, filtering out a very small portion of the electromagnetic spectrum of the energy that we're surrounded by and indeed bathed in. So our senses can be seen as filters that filter out a very small segment of that, which can be processed by our nervous system, which, as impressive as it is relatively puny compared to this amazing display of energy that the universe represents. And so in some way, the entheogens either change the frequency setting, they expand the bandwidth, they enable us to perceive, in my opinion, to have a more accurate perception of the universe, a more accurate perception of something, energy and dynamic flux. Now, the appearance of solidity is an artifact of, I believe, neurologically, something like 70% of the input into our brains is optical through the optic nerve, and we know our linguistic system and so forth is very much tied to visual perception, so much so that with our eyes, what we see are reflections off of surfaces. So we're getting a very superficial view on the world. We're just seeing reflections off of surfaces. And I think that the entheogens tend to de-emphasize that, and I don't pretend to understand it on a neurological level or a neurochemical level, and anyone who says they do is probably lying, because we really don't have enough information to come up with a coherent theory for this. But in as simple terms as I can come up with, I would say that it enables you to see the universe more as energy, less as matter. And in that sense, it's a type of a dehallucinogen, because that's the way the universe is.
How does hemp fit into the family of entheogens?
Well, again, entheogen is a concept that refers to the context of use rather than any particular type of pharmacology or chemistry, but certainly hemp has been and is still used as an entheogen. It has a very prominent role in India, religious role in India and in Nepal, and especially the Shivaite branches of Hinduism. It's also used as an entheogen in the Coptic Zion Church, the Rastafari religion. It is also used in the Santo Daime religion in South America, although because of legal problems, that's become more or less something that people don't talk about, but it certainly has a role there. It's entheogen is a concept relating to the context of use rather than the pharmacology. I think most people that have familiarity with these substances tend to class cannabis along with the shamanic inebriants. On the other hand, personally, from my own standpoint, my own use, and again, anything I say about this is just based on my own experience and it's my own opinion, I don't find it to be as useful to me as are substances like psilocybin, mushrooms, ayahuasca, peyote, mescaline, and so forth. But it's, again, it's a very individual thing.
Could you talk about plant intelligence, interaction with plants, and the intelligence of consciousness of plants?
Well,
the existence of.
Yes, I guess I'm not really an expert on that, but I could say a few words about it. We hear a lot about plant spirits, and these plants are conceived of in many traditional cultures as being teachers, plant teachers that can teach. Personally, I think that plants are superior beings to animals, and in that they can make their own energy from the sun, they make their own carbohydrates from solar energy, and minerals and water from the soil. We see them as being a type of an inferior life, but it's a different type of a life form, and in many ways it's far superior, something that can set up and deploy, root itself in the ground and deploy its own solar collectors is pretty sophisticated. As far as the idea of plant consciousness and plant intelligence, I think everything that's alive has some form of consciousness or is intelligent. Life itself is intelligence. And any organism is capable of reacting to its environment in very sophisticated ways. It's more a question of the speed at which this happens that really affects our perception, perhaps, of how intelligent it is. But as far as the question of whether the plants are actively teaching us or reaching out to us to convey information, personally, I haven't perceived it that way. I don't have any basis for rejecting that or arguing against it. I don't particularly disbelieve it or believe it. My inclination as a natural scientist is to think something along these lines, a more mechanistic, some would say reductionistic approach, that the fact that plants contain dimethyltryptamine, for example, which is also found in the human and other animal nervous systems, is not in and of itself surprising because it's a fairly simple compound that would be on the pathway from tryptophan, the amino acid, to any number of biochemicals that are found in many plants and animals. Now, plants like us are trying to solve the same problems of survival in this ecosystem with the same building blocks, and nature has a law of, by the law of parsimony, some things are tried early on and work, and they tend to become more or less universal through all co-evolved creatures. And so I think rather that it's more of a type of a coincidence that the plants contain dimethyltryptamine, which is appears to be a type of neurotransmitter in our nervous system and other animal nervous systems. And so when we take it, we get this extraordinary effect. Personally, I don't perceive it as the plant reaching out to me to teach me something. Definitely something is being taught. But I think it's not a communication from plant to human being in any kind of sense in which I understand the term of communication. But that's just my particular bias. I don't have any reason to argue against that if people have the other bias.
You're very broad-minded. What are some of the dangers of experimenting, becoming acquainted with the entheogenic plants?
Well, I can't deny that
with
there...
With a specific reference to diet as part of that.
I see. Referring to ayahuasca, for example. Well, there are definitely dangers involved in this. I have been criticized by some people for... I have a more or less libertarian philosophy, political philosophy and economic philosophy, and I feel that it's best to put these substances in the hands of people who want access to them. And so I'm interested in spreading technology, both the genetic packaging, the seeds, the strains of plants that are suitable for this purpose, as well as technology for their processing and use, so that people, as I said, can develop their own relationship with the plants and learn how to handle them themselves. Now, some people think that this is a bad thing, that you need a guide, you need a spiritual guide, you need a teacher. that's experienced in their use. And I'm not denying the value of that as well. Clearly, that's also important. But information can also be got from books. And there are, in fact, in our culture, in the United States, in the late 20th century, there are a number of people that have been using these substances for decades. And many of them consider themselves to be shamans and call themselves such, and perhaps they are. Perhaps we have developed our own type of shaman, urban shamans, basement shamans, and those are some of the terms that have been used. White shamans is another term that I've heard. And so, but what are the dangers? Now, some would say poisoning, overdose, and so forth. It happens that these substances are remarkably non-toxic as a rule, with a few exceptions. If you talk about psilocybin mushrooms or LSD or mescaline or the DMT, the active or visionary agent in ayahuasca, they're remarkably non-toxic substances. And so the danger of poisoning is nil, assuming that one knows what one is getting. Now, when you have these things illegalized by our governments, then you get the problem of adulteration, of misrepresentation, and where black markets are involved. In fact, the authorities are defaulting on their responsibilities to protect the public health in this regard. They should be pragmatic and admit that people are going to use these substances whether we like it or not, and it's our responsibility to make sure that they are using them safely. Some of the European governments are already taking this attitude. Holland is a notable example, where they even have heroin mobiles that go around in Amsterdam on a pointed rounds of stops, give medical exams, clean syringes, condoms, and so forth, and clean, sterile, pure drugs rather than what's available on the black market. So a lot of what are considered to be the problems of toxicity and so forth are artifacts of the black market. Now, if people have access, this is one of the reasons why I favor people developing a relationship with the plants and learning to process them themselves, because then they can know what they are getting and come to master that technology themselves. There's also the danger, I will have to say in no uncertain terms, that entheogens are not for everyone. Some people with particular psychological problems find these things to have rather an irritating or exacerbating effect on underlying problems. But usually, in the great majority of the cases, not every case, people of that type, once they've been exposed on a single occasion to substances like this, avoid them like the plague. And there are some few people that have bad reactions to them that seek them out and keep self-administering them. But, well, people hurt themselves in many ways, not just with drugs. And so, I don't feel it's particularly dangerous in the context of modern urban life in Los Angeles, for example. There are many things, I think just going down the freeway is probably more dangerous than cruising the freeways of the mind with entheogens.
Do you have any inkling on how widespread the use is of entheogenic plants?
In the United States?
In the U.S. and in the world?
Well, the government did a telephone survey some years ago, and of course you could legitimately ask how many people are going to tell the truth about their illicit drug use when the government phones up and says, we want to know. And nevertheless, just from that phone survey, the government estimated 1 million users in the United States. So I would say we have to at least double and probably quadruple that figure to get at a more realistic estimate. Not talking about cannabis, just talking about ayahuasca, mushrooms, LSD, mescaline-type drugs. I would say we're probably looking, just a ballpark estimate, 3 to 5 million in the United States, or something around 1 to 2% of the population, fairly small. On a worldwide basis, it may actually be, it's hard to say. We really don't know enough to be able to say, but maybe that would apply on a worldwide basis. Maybe the chances are the use is maybe heavier in the U.S. than it is in some countries.
Hmm. Now, there's this new book that I have not seen, which is just out.
Yes.
And it is called The Age of Entheogens and the Angels Dictionary.
Yes.
Could you go into some detail about what you've done with this?
Yes, gladly.
Publication.
The first essay, it's a fairly short essay, The Age of Entheogens, the Pharmacratic Inquisition, and the Entheogenic Reformation. And this is an historical theory regarding the importance and history of use of these plant teachers or plant sacraments. And so basically I talk about what my teacher Gordon Wasson called the age of entheogens, or the pre-literate world in general, or what some people choose to call the primitive world. Primitive cultures. I don't use that term because it automatically makes us advanced without having to do anything to earn that qualification. And,
What do you mean? We do war, child abuse.
environmental pollution with the best of them.
Environmental destruction and genocide.
Right. And so I use the term pre-literate. Some people object to that, but it more or less gets the point across. So the age of entheogens is that era in human cultural development or religious evolution, shall we say, in which the entheogens reigned supreme, not just in the shamanic context, but also in as communal substances in organized religions, like the famous Eleusinian mysteries in ancient Greece. And the age of entheogens still lives on today in Amazonia, in the remote parts of the Sierra Madre in Mexico, and in other countries. But basically, for purposes of historical theory making and so forth, I established that in the book that the age of entheogens in the old world, or I call it also Paleogea, ended at the end of the 4th century, strictly speaking in the year 395 A.D., or exactly 1,600 years ago this year, when the Eleusinian mystery cult was destroyed by the Goth king Alaric, putting an end to an organized religious communion that had endured for almost 2,000 years and involved an annual initiatory rite in which the mistes, or initiates, were given a potion called the Kikion, or which means mixture, and it seems to have been a potion containing psychoactive or entheogenic ergot alkaloids, and then they experienced a great vision, and which converted them into epoptes, those who had seen, and or epoptai is the plural, and so from miste to epoptai, and so the age of entheogens drew to a dramatic close at the end of the 4th century in Europe, and several events preceded the destruction of the Eleusinian mysteries. Notably, Constantine reunified the Roman Empire, had been fragmented into three branches, and in the year 324, Constantine reunified the Roman Empire. The following year, he convened the famous Council of Nicaea, in which 300 Christian bishops codified a particular dogmatic version of the Christian faith, and some years later, Christianity was officially declared the state religion of the Roman Empire, and in a very dramatic fashion, the Christians went from food for the lions in the Colosseum to the avenging persecutors of the pagan past. And by the year 384, another significant event was the conversion of Augustine from the Manichaean religion, which was an entheogen-based religion, to Christianity. And he immediately denounced the Manichaeans and went on to become a very important force in Christian philosophy. By the year 391, the emperor was Theodosius I. He decreed not only expropriation of the property of all of the pagan temples, but illegalized any other religion in the Roman Empire besides Christianity. And that same year, the bishop Theophilus I of Alexandria led one of the great destructions of ancient art and literature in the Library of Alexandria. And 4 years later, the Goth king Alaric destroyed the sanctuary at Eleusis and put an end to the Eleusinian mysteries, which was really a type of spiritual beacon or omphalos, or spiritual center of the ancient world. This really marked the ascendancy of this new religion, the Christian religion. And so the age of entheogens, we can say pretty definitely, came to an end in the year 395 in the old world. And then there succeeded a thousand-year reign of terror of the Christian theocracy, the Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church of Rome, destroying any of the competing religions. Why were they so vigorously trying to do this? Because their religion was based on a placebo sacrament. The sacrament had been reduced to a mere symbol, and if the marks had access to the real thing, if they could go to another religious cult like the Eleusinian mysteries and have a real sacrament, it would be patently obvious that what the Christians were selling was a type of a shell game. Now, there's a real magic drug, prestidigitation. The wafers and wine were magically transmogrified into a sacrament. And this actually wasn't codified in Catholic dogma until the 11th century as the doctrine of transubstantiation, which said basically that the priest, with his back to the congregation and mumbling in a low voice in Latin some words over the bread and the wine, would magically transmogrify them into a sacrament. So it's not a coincidence, or not even surprising either, that this 1,000-year reign of terror that I call the Pharmacratic Inquisition, directed against the surviving entheogen cults in Europe, coincides with what we call the Dark Ages. The destruction of, in order to suppress this, they had to destroy all the ancient art and literature referring to this, and since it was a fundamental feature of ancient thought, this set humankind back a millennium. And the Reign of Terror came to a type of a climax in the beginning of the 13th century with the Albigensian Crusades, which were directed against the Albigensians, or Cathari, who were survivors. They were Manichaeans living in Europe, and this was a very important religion competing with Christianity, which traced its ancestry back to the Indo-Aryans, to the Zoroastrian faith, and was almost certainly based on the ingestion of an entheogenic sacrament, probably a mushroom, and likely Amanita muscaria. And the very ferocity of the Albigensian Crusade, in which a million people